So I entitled my talk tonight, On the Way to No Self. And I kind of wish I had written it correctly. On the Way to Not Self. Because the teaching isn't that we don't have a self, but it's not what we think it is. It's not the self that we cling to. I'll try to just take little bites of this idea at a time. And start by saying, as some of you know, I'm teaching a college course. And its title is World Conflict. And the heart of the issue, as I'm teaching the class, based on anthropology, cultural anthropology, is identity. People will kill for me and us and whatever it is that we want or fear. The need to be something feels so powerful that when my group is attacked, I will fight back. Now, there may be good reason for that. World War II is generally considered a good war. That leaves an awful lot that weren't. But what I'm finding in this class, trying to build an appreciation of what worldwide conflict is about, is a tremendous amount of resistance. The first week, I introduced the idea of cultural differences, and I showed film clips of very strange people doing some very strange things, eating foods that made people a little queasy just to think about. The second week was non-judging, which was to try to let go of all of that reactivity that they had the first week. And the third one was the idea that conflict starts inside the individual. And tomorrow, I'm going to address this core issue of identity and how we cling to it. For example, I mean, you probably have enough familiarity with this phenomenon that you can see how rival gangs will ramp up the energy and the motivation to conduct a drive-by shooting through constructing symbols and rituals of the gang identity. And that gang identity becomes so strong that, you know, they're willing to commit pretty heinous crimes to hold on to it. That's some powerful clinging. Do you remember how there were flags everywhere after 9/11? Everywhere. And Bill Maher lost his TV show because he said that you couldn't accurately call the terrorists cowards. It just was the wrong use of the word. How can you be a coward and drive an airplane into a building? You might be reprehensible, but you're not a coward. And because he went against all of this reactive contracting of the national identity that was going on back then, French fries were being condemned because the French wasn't going along with the American war. Because Bill Maher didn't go along with that, he was fired. Now, I can remember being very careful back then how I talked to strangers. That kind of pressure to join in the patriotic thinking of the time was the same kind of thinking that led the Japanese elders of this church to be interned in detainment camps during World War II. So if this is how powerful group identity is, can you see how powerful self-identity is? You're getting some idea of the strength of this clinging that we do to the idea of me, mine, what I am. It's so much stronger, really. It's so much stronger than anything else that goes on in our minds. I need or want this. I have to fend off that. Something is good or bad for my family, my career, my security, whatever. And it all comes from believing in the reality of these identities. I can either be a part of us or I can be opposed to them. Or I can oppose being anything other than what I think I am. And this is that internal conflict that my class had a really hard time dealing with last week. This idea that conflict starts within the individual. Because we've got all these identities, and they don't go together. Some of them are as contradictory as passages, two or more passages, you can find in the scriptures of any religion. You know, and a religion that many millions of people take on as an identity. And it contains internal contradictions. And so does our self-concept, because these identities don't fit together as neatly as the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. In fact, they'll clash very often. And then there are these bits of our identities that we don't live up to, because our subconscious is hiding from us the fact that we're not really that keen on it. But still we beat ourselves up for not living up to that identity. And our deeply cherished idea of values is right in the middle of all of this. Our idea of values is the architecture of our identities. We tell ourselves why we want to be this or that. So when I come along as a teacher of the Dharma or anthropology, and I say that your identities aren't real and they cause bad things to happen, it's understandable that there's going to be some big time pushback. And people always bring up that their values are a part of their identities. And they reject, whenever I get anywhere close to challenging that, because what I'm saying appears to go against those values. For example, family, country, honest work, and self-sufficiency. These are the values of being an American. They're good. They're good values. So students will resist my invitation to question this, even when they can accept that it's okay to question their values. even seeing that maybe the identity they're defending isn't the same thing as the good intentions inside the values. So in other words, the intention to do honest work isn't really the same thing as the American work ethic. The intention to take care of the people who are dependent on me isn't the same thing as defending my family name. What I'm saying is that the kernel of a really good intention is often dressed up in a way of saying a value that, again, just supports the identity that we want to have. Is that clear as mud, or? It's okay to question your identity and your values, and the values that are holding up the identity. That doesn't mean that you have to give up living life according to good intentions. But when they're dressed up in sound bites, be cautioned, because the chances are they're part of this groupthink that, again, is the architecture of some identity that we're just clinging to. So it really is okay to question values, and it's really okay to question identities. And in fact, it's one of the main assignments that Buddha's teachings have given us. In fact, it's the main one. The reason why Buddha's teaching of not self is so difficult is because we're so inside our self-identity that we can't look at it. It's like trying to see your face without a mirror. And keeping true to that analogy, the identity that is hardest to see is what is me, this idea of what I am. So, like a mirror, this is why we have meditation. It's like the equipment that lets us snorkel or scuba dive into our own minds and hearts and see what's in there. Actually, it takes all of the Eightfold Path to really look at what I am. Not me, Rebecca, but you, fill in the blank with your preferred name. It takes an effort to notice the contents of the mind and to see that there's some deep stuff maybe that we've forgotten, as well as the very clear and present thoughts that we're busy thinking in the moment. How all of this can cause us to do stuff that, if we could take an overview, we would really not want to do. So what I'm talking about here is the ethics aspect of the Eightfold Path. Because we set this kind of sound bite idea of our identity, of ourself, we're not really investigating until we sit down in this room and we open our hearts and minds to some new possibilities. But the normal non-practitioner doesn't investigate where conduct comes from that doesn't jive with the identity. It's sort of this vague discomfort and puzzlement. But when we sit down and meditate and allow ourselves to see what's really going on in the mind and to pay attention to the bubbling up from the subconscious, we begin to see something other than what we thought we were. And then we're able to entertain some apparently counterintuitive ideas and begin to rearrange what some cultural anthropologists or psychologists call the cognitive grid, our construction of reality, if you will. So we can let things shift around in the way we've constructed reality and begin to see things in a new way. And that's the wisdom part of the path. Wise knowledge, coupled, of course, with wise intention. And that intention hinges on not harming. So if we have all aspects of the Eightfold Path, wisdom, ethics, and practice, and follow them until they culminate in this new way for the mind to work, we can be completely liberated from the conflicts and the torments that our normal minds inflict upon us. That's the promise of the Dharma. Completely liberated from suffering. At peace, content, all the time. How does that sound? Buddha managed to accomplish all of this without a teacher, and that led to his enlightenment. There are many suttas in which he proclaimed his accomplishments, and a couple of those suttas were originally called the hair-raising suttas, because Buddha's proclamation was so powerful and so impressive. Two of them later became known as the Lion's Roar, and that's their title today, the Lesser and the Greater Discourse on the Lion's Roar. And that roar has become a formula. It's translated a little differently from time to time, but basically it goes like this. Birth is destroyed. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. So when we look at that statement, our culture-bound way of seeing things, modern science, if you like, we can have a lot of resistance to this idea of reincarnation and the idea of destroying birth or rebirth. To overcome my own resistance, I focus on that last phrase, there is no more coming to any state of being. Meaning, in part, I no longer have to be anything. I no longer need any identity. I'm not saying that I no longer need it, but when I get there, that's what it'll be. The teachings of the Buddha provide a path to liberation from having to be anything, any identity. And when I type those two words on my notes, Windows Word didn't want to let me do that. It really wanted me to make it one word, that I'm not anything. But the key to releasing our minds from this rut that we're in is to break out of this habit of thinking of me as a thing, as something that is what it is, and it's going to go on being that. As John Lennon said, imagine there's no heaven. Or in terms of Buddhist culture, imagine no reincarnation. No hell below us. No us to suffer life after life. Bhikkhu Bodhi wrote the introduction to the version of the Lion's Roar that's on Access to Insight. And he says quite definitively that the foundational principle in Buddhism is anatta, or not self, emptiness. Again, it doesn't mean there's no self, but there's not a self. That's what we probably come to call a soul, an ongoing, independent existence, and one to which we cling very deeply. On the other hand, there's this other extreme. The Buddhist teachings do not mean that we should be contemptuous of existence, or, and to quote Bhikkhu Bodhi, that the entire life process comes to an absolute end with the breakup of the body at death, so that at death a being is annihilated and exists no more in any way. So these are the two extremes, and Buddha rejected them both. There are several places in the sutta where the Buddha suggested, sometimes gently, sometimes not, that students just not think about themselves. And certainly not to think about themselves quite so much, preferably not at all. The more we think about ourselves and what we are, the more we mire ourselves in suffering. Certainly, the more we do it, the more we're going to fear death. Because something in us knows that we can't take ourselves with us. And the identity to which we are clinging just throws a tantrum whenever it confronts the very idea of annihilation. That self is going to be annihilated. But that doesn't mean that the life process comes to an abrupt end, and that what has existed will no longer exist. But can you see how the thought of your own death holds this germ of suffering? And it's not even your death. It's the death of an idea, an identity. There are four stages of enlightenment in Theravadin Buddhism. And the first one is stream entry into a stream that will naturally carry us to complete liberation. This first stage comes about in a meditative state when we have loosened the fetters that bind us to suffering. And these fetters are three mental habits, one of which is self-identity beliefs. So we need to get at least somewhat comfortable with thinking that the way we see ourselves and cling to it is, first of all, not real, and secondly, not at all helpful to us. In fact, it is the source of all of our suffering. And I don't mean things going wrong out there in the world. I mean, on a perfectly fine day, we can still be miserable. That's what I'm talking about. Okay? And in fact, on a perfectly miserable day, we can still be fine. That's what I'm talking about. But we've got to at least make peace with the idea that our identity is a blast of hot air. And it's based on things that we not only can afford to question, but will really benefit if we do. So this is why we teachers keep coming back to talking about this key role of self-identity. And in fact, in one of these suttas about the lion's roar, Buddha made it crystal clear that this is the essential teaching of Buddhism, and that there, without it, there is no Buddhist Dharma to lead us to liberation from suffering. Now, as I speak, we're all on the way to not self, because you just listened to me. I didn't see anybody jam their fingers in their ears and run out of the room. So, you know, the mind has taken in this basic introductory concept. And we can go on kind of taking these little steps toward this moment when we have so weakened the fetter of the belief in self-identity that in meditation we can enter the stream that will inevitably lead to nirvana. And it's not an extraordinary event. It happens to a lot of people. There are monasteries in Asia that kind of guarantee you come here, you do what we say, and X amount of time, you're going to enter the stream. So it happens. It happens all the time. It happens to people you know. And it's a process. It is this process of being satisfied not to have a perfect picture of what the destination is going to be like. Not having something that you can immediately substitute for the self-identity that you're clinging to. Just accepting the idea that it would be okay to let go. Even if the mind is not yet capable of understanding what this means, you can still kind of pay attention as whenever the idea comes up. And you'll start to feel a little cognitive shift going on in the structure of your mind, and begin to see a little bit of the cement that holds it all together awkwardly start to crumble and kind of trickle away. My experience over the years has been one little eureka moment after another. Now the elation is quickly tempered by the next level of puzzlement. But at some point in our retreat practice, particularly as we are able to deepen our practice with concentration, we gain a great comfort, a great confidence that we are on the right path, that this is working, that even though I don't really understand what the heck Rebecca's talking about, I'm able to entertain the idea. I'm able to watch things shift a little bit. And this confidence can bring with it a dedication to keep reaching for this high-hanging fruit. Each time we get closer to full realization, we shed another delusion of who we are. Eventually, as Buddha promised, as he proclaimed in his deafening, hair-raising roar, there will be no more coming to any state of being that torments us. Thank you.